The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group, in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Rex Tillerson has shown the door. We'll examine why Donald Trump made this move.
He and Rex Tillerson just didn't think the same way, and he and Mike Pompeo do think the same way.
Michael Medved joins us for a look at the upcoming meeting between President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un.
If President Obama had done exactly the same things, would he be praised, do you think? I actually think he would be.
And Attorney General Jeff Sessions explains how far-left judges are wielding a tremendous amount of power.
So it's really a disruptive thing that a single judge, as you noted, in a single district, stops the entire policy of the United States government.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Earlier this week, President Donald Trump fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, ending months of friction between Tillerson's entire staff and the White House. In his place steps Mike Pompeo, the can-do personality man many feel is just what we need in the post. He's highly intelligent, brings energy into that department. Shortly after the announcement, Salem host Mike Gallagher discussed Tillerson's firing with Byron York, columnist for the Washington Examiner.
The president tweeting out Rex Tillerson, we wish him well, he's out. He wants to nominate CIA Director Mike Pompeo. What are your immediate takeaways over Rex Tillerson being removed as Secretary of State?
Well, you know, we didn't know it would happen on this day at this hour, but this is not a surprise. I mean, it was going to happen at some point that Rex Tillerson was going to go, so it's not a surprise. It's also not a surprise that Mike Pompeo is going to take his place, or has been nominated to take his place. It's pretty clear that Pompeo has been getting along very well with the president. Pompeo has gotten up and gone from CIA headquarters in Virginia into the White House every morning to personally deliver the president's daily brief, the assessment of security threats all around the world, and has developed a rapport with the president with all that face-to-face time. And Pompeo, obviously just a very impressive individual anyway, former congressman from Kansas, first in his class at West Point, Harvard Law, just a very able fellow.
I watched him Sunday with John Roberts on Fox News Sunday. John was filling in for Chris Wallace. And I remember thinking halfway through that interview, because he was calm, cool, collected, and just a rock. You're right. He's a really, really impressive individual.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I talked with him at Fox that morning before the program, and unfortunately he would not reveal any secrets to me. So he has the kind of discretion that's necessary in an in a CIA director, and clearly that'll be useful as Secretary of State. But, you know, what President Trump said not long after the news came out, which was that he and Rex Tillerson just didn't think the same way, and Mike Pompeo do think the same way. The president specifically mentioned the Iran nuclear deal, which, you know, comes up every 90 days for reassessment, and the president has just been wanting to get out of it, and he's been talked out of doing that every 90 days, four times so far, and I think he's getting very impatient with it. And
the timing of this, Byron. Yeah. I mean, North Korea really was the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back on this, right? With Rex Tillerson.
Well, it could be. I think there's a bunch of different things. North Korea is obviously an issue. Iran is an issue. Maybe the tariffs were another issue. But I think it had been a collection of things, and I think that Trump simply felt a couple of things. He did not think that Tillerson was as dynamic a Secretary of State as he wanted, and I believe he thought that Tillerson was basically captured by the very, very daunting State Department bureaucratic establishment early on, and wasn't doing the kind of outside-the-box thinking that Trump wanted his people to do across the administration.
For the rest of the interview with Byron York, go to townhallreview.com. Of the many worldwide threats to the United States, few are as direct as those coming from the rogue nation of North Korea. President Trump has employed tough talk with that foreign leader, and the back and forth between Trump and Kim Jong-un on Twitter was mocked in the media just weeks ago. But suddenly, Kim Jong-un is willing to talk. My friend and colleague Michael Medved looks at that development.
The whole world is talking about North Korea and the upcoming meeting between President Trump and the dictator of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. By the way, one of the things that bothers me about this whole story and the way it's being covered is on cable news, they've started calling Kim Jong-un KJU. Okay, look, if you're a four times elected president of the United States, you can be FDR, right? If you're a war hero and then a U.S. senator and then president of the United States, you can be JFK. But I'm sorry, when you are the portly dictator of North Korea, who was only there not through any election, but through the luck of ancestry. I mean, you got this particular job because your grandfather was an evil mass murdering dictator. And then your father was an evil deranged mass murdering dictator. A KJU, that kind of makes him almost respectable, which it seems to me is the idea of this whole meeting. Is this a triumph for President Trump, or is it a disaster and a trap waiting to happen? 1-800-955-1776. The way that it was covered on CBS News, I think, indicates some of the press's difficulty in coming to terms, which is with a very, very profound development.
South Korean National Security Advisor Chung Uy-young made the stunning announcement after dark outside the White House. North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un wanted a face-to-face encounter with the American president.
He expressed his eagerness to meet President Trump as soon as possible. President Trump appreciated the briefing and said he would meet Kim Jong-un by May to achieve permanent denuclearization.
Okay, to achieve permanent denuclearization. How that would work, we don't know. How it would be monitored, we don't know. Is it a worthy goal? It is. Do I think that President Trump is making the right move here? One of the questions I would ask folks, and this will get different answers from people on the right and the left. If President Obama had done exactly the same things, would he be praised, do you think? I actually think he would be, and would be very, very broadly praised. And I think that there probably would be a bit of grumbling on the right and people saying, well, why is Obama doing this? This is a mass murdering maniac. But actually, I do think the president deserves praise here, and I think it's a hopeful sign for the country. And it became fairly clear that even mass media like CBS that have not been particularly kind to President Trump or his administration had to look at this as an historic opportunity, if nothing else. CBS continued.
It is not without significant risk. Both men are unpredictable and have little diplomatic experience. There is no Assistant Secretary for Asia, and the president has not appointed an ambassador to South Korea.
They will be met with fire and fury.
It is quite a turnaround from the heightened rhetoric of the last year, when the president regularly ridiculed Kim.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
Kim called the president a dotard and mentally deranged.
Okay, and of course, people in American media have done much worse in terms of the president of the United States. Look, this is one of those things where Winston Churchill, who nobody thought was a dotard or mentally deranged, I guess they're probably Nazis who did and said so, but Winston Churchill once said it's better to jaw than to war. That, yes, it is certainly better to try to avoid a confrontation And if you can achieve a denuclearized Korean Peninsula, then that's a very good thing. Here's the basic way that this lines up, it seems to me, from everything I'm able to read and gather and conversations that I've been able to have over the years about Korea. The one thing the North Korean regime wants most is to survive. That's kind of an instinct of any regime, of any individual, of any animal. You want to survive. They know that if there were any war with South Korea, they would lose, and they would lose badly. South Korea is a formidable military power, especially with the backing of the United States, but even without it. They want assurances, which, by the way, is the same thing that happened with the Cuban Missile Crisis. Why did they put Russian missiles in Cuba? They were afraid of another Bay of Pigs. They were afraid that the United States, which is this overwhelming power, would actually come in and invade Cuba and take it over and knock out the Castro regime. We could have done that. And they put in the missiles to try to prevent that from happening. And then what happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was the closest the world has ever been to nuclear war, it was in October of 1962. What happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis was that ultimately a deal was made. And the deal was that in back channels, without a lot of publicity, President Kennedy made it clear, no, we would not invade Cuba. No, we would not come in there and knock out that regime and send the U.S. Air Force and the Marines and the Army to take over this island 90 miles away from U.S. territory. We wouldn't do that. And in return, the Russians would move their missiles out, and we also moved some missiles. We had Jupiter missiles in Turkey. So it was a deal. President Trump says he likes deals. If that kind of deal can be struck, where there actually is, in return for the removal of missiles and nuclear capacity and monitorable, verifiable denuclearization, an assurance that there will be no aggressive military action against Korea, well then, a deal worth making? And of course, it would also include with removal of the sanctions, because President Trump is right that the sanctions have helped to bring us to this point. CBS had this concluding comment in their coverage.
Early Thursday, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson expressed skepticism about talks. But this morning, he claimed Kim's dramatic change of posture led the president to agree to a meeting.
This was the most forward-leaning report that we've had in terms of Kim Jong-un's not just willingness, but his strong desire for talks.
And yes, I think that the idea of talks is a positive.
Coming up.
So it's really a disruptive thing that a single judge, as you noted, in a single district, stops the entire policy of the United States government.
A fascinating discussion with Attorney General Jeff Sessions when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Every student of government learns about the separations of power established by our founding fathers. But how confusing it must be to those students who are witnessing the events taking place in the federal courts today as federal judges upend laws created by lawmakers and executive actions taken by President Trump. It's one key reason why a Republican Senate and a Republican president are so crucial right now. I spoke with Attorney General Jeff Sessions about a little-known power grab taking place in the court system. It's unprecedented what's going on in the United States courts, and you laid out the stats. So why don't you explain to people how Donald Trump has been blocked by one district court more in 1 year than all of the previous presidents in American history combined?
It is a remarkable thing. For example, absent three different interventions by the U.S. Supreme Court, we would be in a horrible, horrible position, even worse than we are today. But you bring up a case, somebody sues us in the Ninth Circuit, like on DACA. You remember President Obama said he didn't have the power to do DACA. Congress considered the DACA-type legislation and rejected it. Then then Homeland Security under Obama issued the order anyway to do what Congress had rejected, and our new leader withdrew that order. and just put it back to what the normal law was. Well, they sued us and said you can't even withdraw what was illegal ever to implement. And then they got a judge to bar us from withdrawing it. And we've got two judges now, at least, where the San Francisco judge, amazingly, said that no, they could withdraw this unlawful DACA order, whereas a Maryland judge says no, we can't withdraw it. Which order holds?
Well, it's you have 600
from doing it.
600 district judges, and if each one of them can issue national injunctions that bind the president as opposed to simply dispose of the case before them, we have 600 chief executive officers in the United States.
That is exactly right, and it takes so long. If you get a circuit like the Ninth Circuit that's so activist, then you've got to go to the Circuit Court of Appeals and only then to the Supreme Court. The United States government is stopped from carrying out its policies for as much as 18 months.
Now, in your speech, you said, quote, the Supreme Court has not yet issued a definitive ruling on the merits of nationwide injunctions. So far, when the court has had relevant cases before them, it has resolved them on other grounds. But we are hopeful that the Supreme Court will soon send a clear message to the lower courts that injunctions ought to be limited to the parties of the case. We believe it is now time for the court to act on this issue. If the court doesn't do something about it now, it will only get worse. In which case do you see the vehicle for reversing this trend towards nationwide injunction, General Sessions?
We have those. We've made that an issue in our appeal in all of our cases. I'm not sure which one would get to the Supreme Court first. It may be the issue of the travel ban, so-called. But we'll have a number of cases where we've got injunctions that we're fighting, and we'll be raising that in each one of them. It was never done before the 1960s, and it's just exponentially grown. President Obama got hit, I think, with 10. We're now at 22 in the first year. So it's really a disruptive thing that a single judge, as you noted, in a single district, stops the entire policy of the United States government. It's not ever been. Normally and historically, as you know, having been counsel for two attorney generals of the United States, you know that that's a power that really should be directed at the parties before the court, not a single judge issuing orders for the whole nation.
I do believe that the rise of modern media has obscured this because they love courts enjoining presidents. It's an easy story to write. A district court has said the president cannot do X, but they don't know that for 175 years, not one district court presumed to do that in this country, that only 22 times prior to Trump's presidency did they do it. But he's been hit with 22 nationwide injunctions in 1 year. That is a big shift, General Sessions, and I think it suggests to us that we're losing self-government to the courts.
That is so right. Look, the Congress is being enjoined many times. The president's being enjoined. Both of them are elected by the people, responsible directly to the people of the United States. Whereas now you have a situation where an unelected, lifetime-appointed single judge appointed for Hawaii or Maryland or San Francisco, they get to decide these questions and stop the entire functioning of the government. It is a question of power. I feel it more deeply than I ever did. Who gets to decide these questions? Where does the power to make decisions lie? Courts are neutral umpires. They're not to be the final word in every dispute. Just because Congress or the president's in a dispute over a policy doesn't mean that the courts get to decide that question. Of course, that's ridiculous.
Do you think that some of our district court judges, and by the way, this would apply, President Obama got hit with a couple of nationwide injunctions. This is bipartisan, that they like the limelight. Do you think they like being the center of attention?
I think, you know, it's hard to know. Sometimes I think they just simply want to teach President Trump a lesson to micromanage his business and make sure they have discovery and lawsuits and they can pry into everything that was done. They want to cite his speeches in the campaign as having something to do with an order that's written before them. They should adjudicate the lawfulness of that order, not what the president said last September or September before last in a campaign. How did this happen? These are the kind of things that they want to depose all his aides and so forth. It's really a dangerous trend.
And we will end up with forum shopping. Now, for the benefit of the Steelers fans, that means that lawyers go find the court that is the most radical court they can figure out, and they bring the case there, General Sessions. The other is we got vacancies. We got 146 judicial vacancies and only 54 nominees. We got 5 vacancies on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the circuit that I used to work in. 18 district court judges open in the Ninth Circuit. That's because Dianne Feinstein has a committee that is approving and not approving judges. Where did that come from? That's unconstitutional as can be.
Well, we need to move on these circuit judges. But traditionally, senators for district judges play a big role, as you know. But you are correct. We've got 12 circuit judges confirmed, which is more than almost any president has had. But there are nominations for, we've got 100, like you said, 140 some odd vacancies.
Let's talk about those 18 district judges in the Ninth Circuit. Why, all we have are Democrat senators on the West Coast. That means every district court judge is going to be a Democrat judge. And that's not in the Constitution. That's simply wrong. Can you go back to your friends in the Senate and say, we have to rethink this because we're going to condemn parts of the country to activist judges for the rest of their lives?
Here, you're raising a very, very important point. On a big state like California, traditionally, if a home state senator blocked and refused to support a nominee for a district judge, other senators in the Senate would not vote for them as a respect, as a senatorial courtesy. This is getting out of hand when you have two very, liberal senators from California, and they want to pick the judges or block so many judges when the president of the United States under the Constitution is the one that gets to make the nomination.
Coming up, students shut down Christina Hoff Sommers.
There was a large contingent of protesters that looked like something out of South Park.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's a unique graduate program impacting policy decisions today, preparing public leaders for tomorrow. The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. A lot of attention has been on college campuses as many radical students keep conservatives from speaking, even those who aren't far right. For example, Christina Hoff Sommers, a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. She is a self-described feminist, but she dares to care about boys as well. And this has some on the far left a tad upset. When Hoff Sommers recently spoke at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon, protesters tried to shut her down. Michael Medved spoke with Sommers after the event.
Did you know that you were going to be disrupted, that they were going to try to shut down your ability to speak?
I had no idea until a few hours before. And the student group that invited me was a student chapter of the Federalist Society. And this young man wrote me and said that there were some, disturbing things being posted around in emails and so forth. And he sent one to me, which was signed by a number of student organizations, describing me as a well-known fascist coming to campus.
Well, see, I've known you for a long time. When did you become a member of the fascist party?
I don't know. I'm still a registered Democrat, a moderate feminist, a philosophy professor. I don't know how they got this information, although I will say it might have been because the Southern Poverty Law Center put me on a list as a enabler of male supremacy.
What?
So they may have, yes.
What?
That they, yes, just as they've listed, Ben Carson is called a fascist, or he was on some kind of blacklist. And they've done this to Ayaan Hirsi Ali and to other Muslims.
No, it's appalling. They did it to Focus on the Family. And a Focus on the Family was portrayed by Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group. The point about this is, do you have some sense of what position you have taken or what cause you've advocated that has upset these leftist crazies most?
I think because I though I am a feminist, I'm a dissident feminist. I challenge some of the radical rhetoric as well as the twisted theories about the capitalist heteropatriarchy. I just don't find that helpful. So I'm always kind of visit campuses and ask for some more moderate attitudes to be represented. And I argue for a reality-based, judicious feminism. I did write a book, The War on Boys, where I document how boys are falling behind in school. I had a piece in the New York Times that got a lot of attention a few years ago, pointing out the deficits of boys. And I think it was these articles and books about boys that they interpreted as being an enabler of male supremacy. And if anyone who's listening looks at the videotapes of my parents at Lewis and Clark Law School, emphasis on law school. These are not, you know, 18, 19-year-old undergraduates at Bates College or Oberlin. This is a law school. These were adults. And there was a large contingent of protesters that looked like something out of South Park. The leader had a jacket that said, "Stay Woked." And she was reading. She couldn't even memorize her own chants. She was reading them off her cell phone, interrupting me with chants and songs. And outside, I think it was the local Antifa came, this so-called anarchist group.
Okay, what was the announced topic of your speech that you weren't allowed to give?
It was called The Closing of the Feminist Mind.
Okay, so that sounds provocative.
I was going to urge they open their minds, too. And it was an emphasis on the need for free expression, the need for rational scholarship. I point out in the beginning of all my lectures that I welcome criticism. I welcome...
As I understand, there was a diversity dean who came up and cut your speech short. Is that right?
Yes. She came up to the podium and said, "Why don't you just stop and take their question?" And I guess she judged it, you know, but I was on page two. I'd had so many interruptions. I was never able to put forth my argument. I feel sorry for the students at Lewis and Clark and even maybe some members of the administration because they're afraid of these students. And these students have apparently created havoc at that school.
How do we address this shameful situation at so many colleges and universities across the country?
Well, I have to say, and this was something that was in my lecture, I didn't get to say, but people say, well, why are the students acting out like this? Are they over-trophied millennials or snowflakes? And this, I don't find any of that helpful because the root cause that I think has driven these kids over the edge is in the curriculum. What were they taught when they majored in gender studies or peace studies or many of these studies, you know, programs, ethnic studies? They learn radical theories which are supported by inflated statistics about how much of a failure our society is. And now we see this on both the far right and the far left, a willingness, you know, no trust in our institutions and sort of contempt for the mainstream society. The far right is not in the universities. It's a problem, of course, but the far left is in the universities.
Go to townhallreview.com for the entire MedVed Summers discussion. While you're there, sign up for the podcast. Never miss an episode. Coming up.
People who have had sex reassignment surgery were shown to be 19 times more likely than the average population to die by suicide.
A thoughtful examination of today's gender controversy when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. There has been a lot of shouting back and forth on the gender controversies, and for the most part, I've steered clear of it. Too often, the arguments lack heart. These are real people involved with real issues, real struggles. Ryan Anderson, a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, has a deep understanding of the topic. Ryan Anderson's latest book is When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. You can't change chromosomes. What I've always wondered is, even if you change bodily function, you can't change chromosomes. Can they ever actually alleviate that discomfort with their therapies?
So there's no robust evidence that it does fully alleviate that tension and that suffering. I go through a bunch of studies in the literature reviews that kind of do the mega studies. And even as recently as 2 years ago, the Obama Administration Center for Medicaid and Medicare pointed out that there's no robust study that exists that show that sex reassignment surgery actually improves the psychosocial outcomes for for patients. And there's quite a bit of studies that show that their underlying problems remain and in some cases worsen. In one of the largest studies that was conducted in Sweden, people who have had sex reassignment surgery were shown to be 19 times more likely than the average population to die by suicide.
Oh my gosh.
And those statistics are shocking.
Well, would you run that past me again more slowly?
Sure. So the largest and most robust study that's been conducted on this, it comes out of Sweden, it showed that people who had sex reassignment surgery were 19 times more likely than the average population to die by suicide. And what the Obama administration and the Medicaid and Medicare report pointed out is that many of these poor outcomes don't manifest until 10 years after the reassignment procedures. And so many of the media headlines that you'll see now that show sex reassignment is a glowing success, they're looking at outcomes a year or two or three after the procedures. And we need to look at the long-term outcomes for people who try to transition.
I'm talking with Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation. His brand new book is When Harry Became Sally. You can follow Ryan on Twitter at RyanTAnd, Ryan T. And. Ryan, let's do some numbers as well. How many people in the United States, just total number, identify with gender dysphoria?
So historically, the number has been somewhere between 0.4% and 0.6% of the population. But a troubling new report that came out in the journal, I believe it was Pediatrics, about 3 weeks ago, showed that 3% of current high school students have gender dysphoria or identify as gender nonconforming. And to see such a large increase, let's say from 0.5% to 3%, suggests that the more that transgender identities and gender fluidity are mainstream concepts, the more that young people live out those identities.
Well, gender fluidity is very different from gender dysphoria. That to me, when you tell me teenagers say that, that means their hormones are raging and they want to jump into bed with everybody. That's what it tells me. But when you've got gender dysphoria, you've got a million people, if my math is right, historically who identify with it. That's not an insignificant number of people. So it's a large dynamic. But most Americans, when they talk about this, actually don't talk about this. They don't want to talk about it. In fact, I saw that a boy who transitioned to be a girl in high school won a state wrestling championship recently. Did you see that story?
Yeah, so this is actually a girl who was transitioning to be a boy, competing against the other girls, but this girl was taking high doses of testosterone to masculinize her body, and she won that state championship for the second year in a row.
Okay, so she has not yet finished her transition, but she is still competing as a woman.
Correct.
Now, in situations like that, what is the reaction of parents?
It's mixed. Some people see this as the next frontier of civil rights, and so they cheer and applaud. Other people think something radically unfair took place, that all the other girls competing in that wrestling tournament weren't taking testosterone, and that this would have been viewed as a performance-enhancing drug had it not been used for transitioning procedures. In Alaska last year, a boy who identified as a girl won the state track championship in the girls' competition. And so some of the parents viewed that as a victory for civil rights. Others said, you know, there was a girl who came in second who should have come in first place, but she lost to a boy who was competing as a girl.
But am I right, Ryan, that the spectrum of conversation has so narrowed because people don't want to be dragged into this controversy because there are many big controversies, not involving a million people, but involving 330 million people, like being hit by a North Korean nuke, that they don't have any broadband space left for this issue. Is that what's going on?
Some of that is, but I think some of this, people are just intimidated. They've been bullied and they've been silenced. Because if you're a parent, this can frequently be a much more real threat to your daily life, a real concern to your daily life than a nuclear holocaust. That's actually more of an abstract concern. But if you're a parent and your child has gender dysphoria or one of your child's classmates, that's much more of a pressing concern. And yet people don't have the space to talk about it because of some of the attacks that will be made if they misspeak. And you know, people are stumbling here. How do I even talk about these issues? We haven't had the time or the space.
How would you encourage a parent who is concerned about classmates or child to approach the school in a responsible, level-headed way to raise their concerns about not even wanting to deal with this at this time? They've got other issues in their house. They've got other issues in their life.
I mean, so one of the things that listeners should know is that for young people with gender dysphoria, 80 to 95% of them will naturally grow out of it, will reconcile with their physical body if their development isn't interfered with. So if you're a young boy who's going through a stage when you identify as a girl, a year or two later, if you're just allowed the time and the space to continue growing and maturing, 80 to 95% of the time, you'll be identifying as a boy again. And so one thing here is don't rush to make any radical, life-changing medical decisions at such a young age on people's bodies who are so young. Right now, people are prescribing puberty-blocking drugs to indefinitely block puberty for children with gender dysphoria, and then they're prescribing testosterone to teenage girls and estrogen to teenage boys. A much more cautious approach is to give people the time to develop a more capacious understanding of gender so they don't have rigid sex stereotypes, and to have the time for the developmental mechanisms, including puberty itself, to let them develop and feel more comfortable in their own body.
Coming up.
You know, you didn't like black people getting rights. You don't like women, you know, getting jobs.
Hillary's take on Trump voters when the final segment of the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, where they are preparing leaders for the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. This past week, Hillary Clinton spoke at a conference in Mumbai, India, where she could not resist once again insulting those Americans who voted for Donald Trump. Dennis Prager looks at the bewildering claims coming from the former presidential candidate. We begin with Hillary's words.
If you look at the map of the United States, there's all that red in the middle where Trump won. I win the coasts, I win, you know, Illinois and Minnesota, places like that. But what the map doesn't show you is that I won the places that represent two-thirds of America's gross domestic product. So I won the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward. And his whole campaign, Make America Great Again, was looking backwards. You know, you didn't like black people getting rights. You don't like women, you know, getting jobs.
When did he ever say that? Wait. Why is that not a lie? Wait, excuse me. Why is she not lying to a foreign audience about the man who was president of the United States? Why is that not an out-and-out 100% lie, not 80%? When did he ever intimate you didn't like an America where blacks had rights? When did he intimate that? She lies with such ease that only NPR can match her, because they lie with the same ease. That's why people love NPR. NPR is a left-wing organization, but it sounds so smooth that the people on the left think it's a truth teller. And of course, the New York Times and the whole crowd. But this is it's vile. It's vile what she just did, not to mention on foreign soil.
Was looking backwards. You know, you didn't like black people getting rights. You don't like women, you know, getting jobs. You don't want to, you know, see that Indian American succeeding more than you are. Whatever your problem is.
You're seeing an Indian American?
Wait.
Does she mean an American came from India? Okay. That's troubling a lot of Americans. I hear it all the time. He's Indian American. That's why the conservatives really loathe Dinesh D'Souza. They fund his movies. That's how much they love him. Yeah, I'm telling you, the imaginary world. You see, they have to imagine us, because A, they don't know us. B, they don't read us. C, they don't hear us. D, they don't study under us. So they imagine us. It's like one of the best articles written in the entire Obama era was the straw man that Obama attacked all the time. He made up somebody. God, is it ugly what she does. Anyway, look, she's so bitter and angry and unhappy. And she's talking about the optimistic. Oh, my God. She radiates optimism.
Thanks for joining us on the Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. Start at our site and subscribe to our Apple Podcast or via Stitcher or SoundCloud or Google Play. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Chanda Chisala, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. That's publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Join us next week for another edition of the Town Hall Review, the weekend review program from a perspective you can trust.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.